Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to strategypage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history.
Hello, Jim and Austin. A couple of weeks ago, we had talked about India and some of India's problems with Pakistan and some of their internal problems, but we had not covered some of their other issues. One of the things is their buildups of the arms and their dealings with the Russians in buying arms.
Russia has been the main supplier of India for modern arms for over 30 years now. Through most of the Cold War, India set itself up as apart from the Cold War, for various reasons having to do with politics, economics, etc. We no need to go into that. India was somewhat hostile to the United States during the Cold War, thus the only other source of modern weapons at prices they could afford was Russia, and Russia enthusiastically supported this alleged neutral. That has continued, but because after the Cold War ended, the Russian arms industries basically fell apart. Most of them are gone now. And the ones that are still there survive on export orders, mainly to India and China. India has started buying Western weapons because after the 1990s, the Indians revitalized their economy by dropping the socialism they had clung to, state control, basically. They had clung to for most of the post-World War II period. Now they had money, and they could afford those Western weapons. But they still buy mainly from Russia, and they have been diligently building up their own domestic arms industry to ultimately, replace most of the foreign suppliers. So they are building up their arms capabilities, but they are still basically a 1960s era army. It's an all-volunteer force, but they don't pay comparative wages with the civilian workforce, at least the people they're competing for. India has only about a 60% literacy rate. They have a huge problem out in the countryside where teaching jobs on paper are adequate to provide every child with at least a grammar school education, but the schools are considered part of the local political patronage. So teaching jobs are handed out to political cronies who often don't show up to work. And that has been the shame of India, as one Indian friend of mine put it. And they've been trying to fix it for years, but, getting money away from politicians, as we all know, is a very futile task. But that the army has, and the armed forces have insisted on a literate soldier. In fact, in the technical branches, especially the Navy and the Air Force, they have to come in, recruits, applicants have to come in and take 3 or 4 days of tests, most of them written, before the military decides who they will accept. But because there are more and more opportunities in the civilian market, they actually have a shortage, especially among officers. The Army is short about 20-25% of its officers. They have stayed with the idea that it's better to have a qualified officer than no officer at all. That historically has been a wise move, even though it's embarrassing when you are short so many officers. They fill in as best they can by trying to promote NCOs or simply putting NCOs into officer jobs. But they are very short-handed. But they have about as many troops as the United States on active duty. And they are reasonably well-equipped for the people they have to face, with the possible exception of the Chinese. And they have a growing problem with the Chinese because on their northeastern border with Tibet, China, the Chinese have been making very loud noises lately that that part of India really belongs to China because the boundary was set a century ago and Tibet was independent. Tibet broke away from China when the empire collapsed about a century ago. The Chinese Empire, the imperial rule, was swept away by a democratic revolution. And that was before the communists took over, obviously. And at that point, the British decided to sit down with the Tibetans and decide where the border was in that area. And, of course, the Chinese now say that, hey, no, that was a bad deal. Anyway, it's the usual, you know, border dispute. But the Chinese have been rattling their sabers and saying, you know, if we can't settle this by negotiation, mainly, you know, India, you give us what we want, it may come to blows. They fought a war over that same point, 1962, and it was a fairly low-key war because it's in, up in the Himalaya Mountains. I mean, it's in the lowland part, but it basically has mountains all over the place, and it's very rough, thinly populated jungle hills, et cetera. But the Chinese won, mainly because they just threw more people in there, and the Indians didn't really understand what they were up against. And so now there's an arms race going up, on along that border. And, at least according to the rhetoric, you know, being spilled on both sides of the border, they're gearing up for a fight.
Interestingly enough, let me add something about 62, though. The Chinese, out-prepared the Indians, including when they were moving, troops up there, they acclimated them to the higher, higher altitudes. So they had their strike units had a physical advantage. The Indians started sending reinforcements up, and they had not been prepared to adjust to the lower levels of oxygen. So the Chinese thought that out pretty well in 62.
Yeah, and the Chinese pushed the Indians back into the lower altitudes where the border now resides, the line of control, as they call it. So India wants the highlands back, and of course the Chinese are up there, and the Chinese have been building more roads and more military facilities on their side of the border than the Indians have on theirs. Now, it's only in the last year or so that India officially noticed this. I'm sure somebody must have noticed it. I mean, you could have discovered it 2 years ago with Google Earth. But anyway, the Indian press got a hold of it, and it's become a huge scandal. And so the Indian government has been rapidly putting air bases up there, organizing mountain divisions and transferring them up there. They're putting some of their SU-30s up there so they can fight the Chinese SU-30s. What a wonderful thought that is. And basically preparing for war, which is a an unsettling thought since both countries have ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. And now the Indians have been testing a long-range nuclear, intermediate-range ballistic missile, which can reach most of China.
Now, Austin,
that's the Chinese no end.
Austin,
let me point out something if I can, real quick.
Okay.
Comment on Jim. Jim's talked about the indigenous Indian arms industry, and they really have been they've been producing some of their own weapons for a long time. And they have, there's an article we've got up on Strategy Page, really in the last couple of days.
Several, actually, yeah.
Comparing their own indigenous tank, the Arjun, to the...
Arjun, yeah.
Yeah, Arjun went to the T-90 and the like. There are some Indian systems that are really rather good. Plus, we haven't gotten to their Navy for an Indian Ocean Navy.
Right.
It's really a first-rate force. So.
Well, we've been covering the DRDO. That's the Indian, Defense Research, Office, and they have been putting a lot of money into not only government-owned arsenals, but mainly into private firms to develop this kind of technology, the technological infrastructure. In other words, you need not just one factory that'll build a modern weapon, but 1,000 smaller firms that'll supply the components, everything from computer chips, to special metal fasteners and what have you. And that's what the Chinese have been doing at great expense and great heartache over the last 20 years. And the Indians have been doing as well. But most of our coverage has basically shown the embarrassments and the stumbles you'll take along that road. It's a very rough road, to develop a modern military design and development and manufacturing capability, especially if you're doing it on the fast track. The Western countries, did it at their own speed because they had no competition. They were basically at the bleeding edge, as it were, of that technology. China and India are both interesting in that they are compressing that process, and they are finding, not to the surprise of any of the scientists and engineers involved in the operation, that you make a lot of expensive mistakes. That's one big reason why China, while it has developed a lot, and India too, have developed a lot of high-tech weapons, they have not put them into mass production. As Austin mentioned, you know, we covered the Arjun tank. That was the Indian developed and designed competitor for their new modern tank. And it lost out to the Russian T-90. Now, the DRDO is still pushing the Arjun, and they allegedly conducted an extensive series of field tests between 14 Arjuns and 14 T-90s, which the Arjun allegedly won. I say allegedly because the results of this test are secret, and there were leaks. We know how leaks work. And so, you know, we're still waiting for the dust to settle on that. But so far, the Arjun has been far more screwed up than the T-90. The T-90, as we point out in the articles, is basically just another development of the T-72. It's a good development. It's basically a solid tank. But that's how the Russians roll. They take a good design and just keep improving it. And with tanks, that works, you know, better than with aircraft, where you have to make some radical changes in design, you know, every once in a while. But the T-72, which is the great-great-grandson of the the World War II tank, the T-34, is a pretty solid vehicle. And as long as it's not fighting M1s, American-type M1s or German Leopards or, you know, British tanks, it'll be the best tank on the battlefield. And that's one thing the Indians are basically equipping themselves for. They don't expect to fight the United States or any Western, you know, European country. They're basically looking at neighbors who are equipped with basically Russian weapons, you know, 1970s, 1980s technology.
Yeah.
And in that respect, Arjun could be more than adequate, but unfortunately, you know, until this recent test allegedly demonstrated, Arjun was able to, you know, stand up to, battlefield conditions. The big problem that wasn't resolved, that wasn't even mentioned in this test, was that Arjun is too heavy for the current generation of Indian tank transporters. It's about 58, 59 tons versus 47 tons for the T-90. That is, as any logistician will tell you, and logistics is very important, that is extremely vital. If you haven't got the tank transporters, you can't move tanks long distances. They simply fall apart if you try and run them, you know, on their own tracks for long distances.
I might point out something, too, about the Indian main battle tanks, too. Some of their, this is, again, it's not a new program for the Indians. You can see the roots of some of these, their developmental programs back in the 70s. I guess it's not fair to say extended teething problems, but they certainly have started making a move in the 90s for the indigenous vehicles to make sure that they had the onboard electronics and sight systems and the like. One of the other issues, and I believe, Jim, we had an article about this, I mean, it's several years ago too, about their engine problems that they were having with their armored vehicles, and that, of course, that's a,
yeah, the biggest problems they have is that the main theater for armor warfare for India is the Rajasthan desert. That's the desert border between Pakistan and India, and that is, but as they say, splendid tank territory. Unfortunately, it's bad for everything else that has to do with tanks, namely the engines, and, you know, that's dusty and it's hot, and that's the acid test. In fact, that's where they held this recent series of tests between Arjun and the T-90. And in the past, and we've covered this regularly for, you know, the last 10 years. When they tested the first version of the T-90, the electronics were fried. Even though the Russians were warned, and the Russians knew about this, that it's hot down there, baby. You know, we're talking about 40 degrees centigrade, and we're 120, you know, Fahrenheit or so. And it's very dusty. And as any tanker will tell you, that is not good territory for maintaining tanks. And they've had to basically, you know, desertize their armored vehicles to get them to work in the theater where they'd most likely be operating. On the border, on the northeast border with China, they don't have to worry about that because that is definitely not tank terrain. It's hilly, it's forested, it's not the kind of place you want to send tanks into.
Right. Now, Austin, isn't there some affinity between Israel and India, and that India is getting some technical help from Israel?
Well, this is the question, too, about where the Israelis have technical trade relations or technical technical advisors. The Israelis have long had relations with the relationship with the Turks, and we know on other countries too where Israeli technology tends to end up. We've had some reports on Strategy Page about a certain kind of Chinese systems that may have been, had aid or advice from Israeli military, engineers. But the basic answer to your question is yes, and to the extent of it, I don't know.
Okay.
India, Israel has mainly been supplying high tech to India. Well, that's what Israel basically specializes in. They don't really export, combat aircraft or tanks or even ships for that matter. The Israelis first broke into the Indian market in the last decade by selling night vision devices at attractive prices, apparently, and sensors to India for better covering the border in Kashmir, where the Pakistanis have been encouraging for over a decade now, two decades. Islamic terrorists to cross the border into raise hell and basically try and drive all the non-Muslims out of Kashmir. That has expanded to sale of anti-aircraft missile systems for the Navy, and now they are selling. I don't know what the status of this contract is, but selling their Arrow anti-missile system, which could stop a lot, not all, of the Pakistani ballistic missiles, which are basically Chinese/Korean, North Korean designs. So Indians are trying to get in there with the high tech, which is their strong suit. They also sold them some Tavor, assault rifles for the Indian special forces. India has a problem that all industrializing countries have with quality control. And that's been a big complaint in the Indian, in the rank and file. They produce not just tanks that don't work as they should, but missile systems and even assault rifles. Indigenous designs, which, the ones they deliver, the first ones they deliver to the military for evaluation are excellent. Then they mass produce them, and the ones that reach the troops are not so excellent. It becomes a big scandal. But that's growing pains.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I find interesting about India is how they have Bangladesh, dividing part of the country. How are they handling the Bangladeshis right now, Austin?
Well, look, Bangladesh has still got its own internal Islamist problem. And look at the Bangladesh's other array of issues, immense endemic poverty, environmental issues, including water issues. By the way, that was something we may end up discussing between India and Pakistan, because they've got water issues that divide them, as well as geographic issues, resource issues. Bangladesh, the one positive about Bangladesh is it still has a fairly potent military force that draws on the traditions of the old British Indian Army, same way the Indian Army does, same way the Pakistani Army does. What India is most concerned about in Bangladesh is that they don't want another theater of Islamist intrigue. Islamist bases, in the same way that they face in Kashmir, are coming out of Pakistan. They've gotten cooperation from the Bangladeshi government far more than they have Pakistan. Remember, India in the Indo-Pakistani war knocked off East Pakistan, which is what Bangladesh is, and they've got really an ally compliant relationship with Bangladesh to monitor the Islamist extremists as well. So, I mean, the general answer to your question is the relationships are good, but they're concerned about the possibility of destabilization. Destabilization isn't solely a result of Islamists, but of the extraordinary, truly extraordinary poverty that Bangladesh has.
One area where Bangladesh and India have persistent problems is along the border, because the because, as Austin pointed out, Bangladesh is a poorer country. You have most of the illegal immigration, is almost all of it, is going from Bangladesh into India. And the Bangladeshi border guards, you know, tend to be sympathetic to poor Bangladeshis trying to leave. They will not, usually will not try and stop them, especially when they're trying to sneak through, you know, the thinly guarded areas. Whereas the Indian border guards are under orders to keep the Bangladeshis out. And what you have happening, and has been happening for decades, is the Indians will sometimes fire, you know, into Bangladesh, firing at these, you know, people who will not stop when ordered to. And if there are any Bangladeshi border guards in the area, they will, you know, taking fire from India, they will fire back. And so periodically you have actually little firefights between India and Bangladeshi border guards. It never gets big, you know, both sides, you know, yelling, screaming, but, you know, things quiet down rather quickly. But you do have a somewhat semi-hot border situation there. And the poor Bangladeshi, you know, illegal migrants, you know, keep on coming. But that is not a deal breaker, as it were. The Indians and Bangladeshis did sit down and agree to, well, the Bangladeshis agreed for financial considerations to crack down on Indian separatist groups who were setting up camp inside Bangladesh, basically as safe havens before they went back to India, you know, to cause whatever mayhem they could get away with. And India's done the same thing with Burma, with Myanmar, which was also tolerating, you know, Indian separatist groups who were setting up camp. So India has managed to, you know, keep the borders with Bangladesh and Burma quiet. There is not a lot of smuggling and illegal migration going along on the Chinese border because, you know, China still keeps fairly tight borders. But that area is getting hot for other reasons.
Now,
Dan, let me point out something, though, about the relationship military to military between India and Bangladesh. When you look back at the Indo-Pakistani War, too, a lot of the Pakistani units in East Pakistan were senior officer positioned by men from West Pakistan. In other words, what is current of Pakistan. So there was a break and a friction between the quote-unquote West Pakistanis and East Pakistanis. As a matter of fact, now some of this was convenient political statements, political propaganda, perhaps, after the separation, after India attacked and created Bangladesh. But a number of the Bangladeshis said, in certain ways, we felt like we were not just dominated, but occupied by Western Pakistan. So you had a basis there for this differentiation, too, between the Bangladeshi military and the Pakistani military, and you had a great deal of influence from the Indian Army and the Indian government in the creation of the current Bangladeshi government, but also its military forces. Despite all the frictions, they communicate with one another.
Yeah, and there's a certain amount of goodwill in Bangladesh because the Indian Army basically rescued them from the, you know, the occupying West Pakistanis. West Pakistani and East Pakistan are two, you know, different ethnic groups. You know, the Punjabis and the Sindhis, you know, in West Pakistan are a continent away. You know, it's like Romania, you know, and Denmark. The only thing they had in common was the Muslim religion, and that wasn't enough, it turned out.
Right. Now, the Indians are trying to project force out into the Indian Ocean and the surrounding environs. Is this so that they can protect resources that they're going to be needing over the next few decades?
Not according to the Chinese. According to the Chinese, the only reason the Indians need a navy is to threaten the Chinese supply lines with the Persian Gulf and, you know, with ships headed for Europe with Chinese goods. But the Indians, you know, even though they are basically a continental power, in other words, they don't depend that much, at least as much as China does, on overseas trade, they say, hey, it's the Indian Ocean. And, you know, it's our backyard. You know, the Navy is technically there to, you know, keep an eye on the Pakistani Navy. But, you know, it's a fairly large Navy. It's the largest Navy in the region. And they are very upset. The Indians are very upset that the Chinese are moving into the region. You know, the Chinese are setting up naval facilities, monitoring facilities mostly, you know, in Myanmar. The Chinese are sending flotillas on regular rotation to off the Somali coast for the anti-piracy patrol. India basically sees its Indian Ocean being invaded by the Chinese. And of course the Chinese say, hey, we're only trying to protect our economic interests. So you can see there's a setup there for, you know, more friction.
Yeah.
Now, let me make another point too that, but this is something we've written about occasionally on strategy page. India has developed, is in the process of developing a de facto former British colonies alliance. It's more than de facto, it's relationship with Singapore. The Singaporean forces, Air Forces actually use some Indian training facilities, but a relationship with Singapore and Australia, and ultimately moving into a stronger allied relationship with the United States. Maybe Australia is the back door to that, but a good number of common interests. One of them, of course, would be containing China, containing at least China's military capabilities. When I point to Singapore, though, the Indian interest in maintaining the Singapore Straits, the Straits of Malacca, keeping them open, they're long-term, they're legitimate. I mean, near the Andaman Islands in the Indian Ocean, they're Indian islands. Maintaining the trade routes coming through the Suez Canal and coming around the Cape of Good Hope. Well, the Royal Navy is not what the Royal Navy was in the 19th and through the mid of the 20th century. And to some degree, yes, the U.S. Navy is there, but you see India, it's a curious kind of power vacuum that it's prevailing. Their nationalist interests, as Jim said, it is the Indian Ocean, but at the same time, they're assuming some of the trade route protection duty that the Royal Navy had. And India sees that as something that it's in its interests, but it's also in a statement about its own rise to regional power and regional superpower, because they really are the hegemonic power in the Indian Ocean. There are complex reasons for it. When I make this sketch that there's a little bit of the British Empire at play here, I don't mean that in a literal sense, but an understanding of keeping it what has been a free passage and a free trade, free sea trade zone protected, and those are legitimate interests by New Delhi.
Yeah. Well, I think we've pretty much covered India, unless you gentlemen have something that we've missed of import. And I think we can just wrap it up there and say that it's going to be interesting to watch India develop, and especially their friction with China and Pakistan, how that all goes over the next 10 years or so. And hopefully we're not going to see any major breakouts there.
Well, one thing we really didn't go into, we sketched at it, was the separatist movements throughout India. Jim had talked about it tangentially in some of these camps, but then again, that is India's long-term political trend is towards more effective nationalist parties to take the edge off of the ethnic disparity and the ethnic dissent, even in southern India as well. So now that's a
The separatist movements in the Northeast are not a major problem, you know, at the national level. They're basically a part of the country that was never part of India. The British, when the British left the region, they had to give that area, these tribal territories, to someone. and India was the logical, you know, person to take it over.
Yeah, but Tamil separate
the tribes in the area.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Tamil.
It's a thinly populated area. You know, there's no military superpower up there. It's not well developed economically. It's not united politically. So you basically have dozens of different tribes and ethnic groups, demanding more autonomy and demanding fewer Indians, you know, migrating to the thinly populated area. It's a problem, you know, but it's mainly a police problem, not a large scale, you know, military political problem.
Okay.
Yeah, but the what I was getting at, though, is one of the concerns that was going on with Sri Lanka was potential Tamil separatism, which would have been a huge issue for India. But I think that's largely navigated.
That's never been an issue. The 19 major, you know, ethnic groups in India have been fairly, content with the union, the Indian Union, as many Indians like to call it. The whole idea of the United States of India, as it were, was accepted rather readily, after the British left. And indeed, many Indians will say, especially after a few shots of good whiskey, that's the one good thing the British did. They united India against the British, of course. But, you know, when the British left, the Indians looked around and said, well, yes, there's much that divides us, you know, like over a dozen major languages. But at the same time, you know, we're all India, and the Indians take great pride in their military power, their diplomatic power, and their growing economic power. And that's something very few Indian politicians, and Indian politicians are as rapacious as any, none have been able to capitalize on this ethnic separatist angle, not in the main India. You know, it happens in the tribal territories, but there you have, you know, very small entities, you know, yelling not very, you know, loudly on the world stage, you know, for independence. But for the, you know, the Indian states that have over 100 million people, I mean, you know, there are Indian states that are more populous than most European countries. It just doesn't resonate.
Right. Well, now we are out of time, gentlemen, and we'll wrap our discussion up on India, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye, Dan.
All right.
Bye.